This is Circe Olson Wessner, the director of the Museum of the American Military Family, and this is our podcast, Together We Serve. I'm speaking with Army veteran Larry Montoya, who lives in New Mexico, not far from our museum. Hi, Larry.
Hello, how are you?
Doing well, thank you. So because we're in a pandemic, I wanted to let our listeners know that we're doing this interview via phone. And most people know that I've been working on projects out of the house because the museum's closed. What have you been doing during this pandemic, Larry?
Well, I've been grounded pretty much. Uh-huh. I'm a member of Team Rubicon. I'm used to deploying around the country to assist Americans with natural disasters. Mm-hmm. But we've been grounded. So, yeah, we've been out helping out Meals on Wheels and the Albuquerque Roadrunner Food Bank. With delivering meals, so try to stay busy.
Yeah, this is a strange and scary time for a lot of us. I do want to come back later on to talk more about Team Rubicon, but let's just kind of learn about your history, your backstory a little. So I know that you served 22 years in the Army, and you're an Albuquerque native. Did you join the Army right out of high school or college?
I did join January 1989. I graduated from Valley High School in May, and I deployed to Fort Benning, Georgia on 15 August 1989.
Wow, so right out of high school.
Yes,
ma'am. Yeah, so why did you decide to join the Army? Are you from a military family?
You know, as a kid, I always grew up playing Army out back, running around, jumping over things, and wanted to be in the Army since I was a kid. My father served in Vietnam as a soldier, and actually have a son who's in the military, in the Army right now.
Ah, so you know our museum is the Museum of the Military Family, and we honor the parents and the kids and the spouses and the grandparents, so you definitely need to come check us out, because this is your museum. So right out of high school, you joined the Army, went to Fort Benning. So what was your MOS? And what was your MOS? And how did you react to basic training?
Yeah, I was an 11 Bravo. I was an infantry soldier.
Uh-huh.
I did that for 22 years. And, it was strange leaving from the desert environment of New Mexico to the plush, green, humid Fort Benning, Georgia.
Yeah.
It took 2 days to get used to that humidity for sure.
Yeah. And that was August, right? That's what you said. Oh my gosh. Bugs. You didn't mention bugs.
No, there's plenty of bugs for sure.
So once you finished up basic at Fort Benning, then did you go to AIT? Where did you go to AIT?
I actually did basic training, my advanced training, and airborne school all there at Fort Benning, Georgia, before I went to my first duty station.
Where was your first duty station?
Fort Bragg, North Carolina. I was a paratrooper.
Oh, okay. So where else were you stationed? And just give us your, some highlights of each place. So where were you stationed? What was your job?
Yes, ma'am. So at Fort Benning, Georgia, I deployed to Operation Desert Shield, Desert Storm.
Mm-hmm.
When I got back, I was reassigned to Camp Hovey, Korea for 12 months, which was a really beautiful place. Mm-hmm. Had a really great time, but 12 months was long enough.
Mm-hmm.
From there, I was stationed in Fort Hood, Texas. Mm-hmm. Still infantry, but as a mechanized soldier. I did that for 3 years before I went to Heidelberg, Germany. There I worked at a Corps headquarters, which was a bit interesting, being away from running around and clearing bunkers and doing all that cool stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Heidelberg, beautiful. We'll have to go back. From there, I went to Fort Carson, Colorado. I spent 6 years there.
Wow, that's long.
Had a great time. I deployed to Iraq in 03 from Fort Carson.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got selected to my final rank, I was moved back to Fort Hood, Texas, where I deployed to Afghanistan. And Fort Hood, Texas is a nice place, but it's just super hot, and I have no desire to ever go back there.
Well, it sounds like you got to experience all aspects of military life there. When you so I know you had four deployments and two to Iraq, one each to Kuwait and Afghanistan. Is that what I understood?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. So when you finally got overseas, because you had some different assignments before you went to a combat zone. When you finally got overseas and experienced combat, what were your initial thoughts? Did you think your training prepared you for combat? And I know each deployment is different, but let's do Desert Storm, Desert Shield, because that was your very first one.
Yeah, it was very interesting. My unit had just came back from Operation Just Cause in Panama, and 8 months later, after 7 months later, after they returned, we turned around and headed out to Iraq. Or actually, we flew into Dahran, Saudi Arabia,
mm-hmm.
Where we spent 4 months training and preparing and waiting for the war to start.
Mm-hmm.
That was interesting. I mean, it was nice because I was around a lot of veterans who had came from combat,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they were a calming, kind of presence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it really helped. You know, being a private, I was the guy doing all the cool guy jobs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it was when the air war started in January, we moved up onto the border.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was just us out there, our trucks and our vehicles, just driving through the desert for hours and hours trying to find bad guys. Mm-hmm. So it was quite a maturing and eye-opening event for sure.
Mm-hmm. So then, do you feel like you were, I know you said that there you had some mentors and some of the other veterans, the soldiers that had been in combat before. Did you feel like you were truly prepared for this, or do you never really truly prepare for combat?
Yeah, things never go the way they're supposed to. Plan only serves only is only good until it's first contact.
Mm-hmm.
So things change constantly. Mm-hmm. But as far as my skills as a soldier and as an infantryman, I felt like I was well prepared.
Mm. And so. Then you had a couple of other assignments when you came back, and then off to Iraq and Afghanistan. So you'd already been in combat, I would say it's almost a decade earlier, or it was a while earlier. And now you're back in Iraq, you're going to Iraq and Afghanistan. So it was a different circumstance, a different time. Did you feel like you were doing the right thing being in Iraq and Afghanistan? And did you learn anything surprising about those experiences or make any interesting, did you learn something new about those countries?
You know, it was things where, I had the opportunity to leave the military before that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something I enjoyed doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I believed that I trusted the mission, trusted
mm-hmm.
our leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And, I deployed as I was assigned. And I didn't have any second thoughts about it. That's the chosen profession I made.
Mm-hmm.
Iraq, 10 years later, was definitely a different place. The environment was the same, but our mission was a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as how we were deployed to chase or try to locate Saddam Hussein, mm-hmm. so we spent pretty much a whole year trying to find him. Beautiful country, I got to see Samarra, Iraq. I got to see the big old Babylonian walls that were still kind of halfway there. A lot of the beautiful countryside of Iraq that people never really get to see, the Euphrates and the different. Really nice people out there.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing for Afghanistan. I was in Assadabad, was the city I was near,
mm-hmm.
along the Pesh River. Again, just beautiful mountainsides, when we weren't getting shot at. Great people.
Mm-hmm.
I think the biggest thing that surprised me was the resiliency of our soldiers. We may have lost a soldier the day before
mm-hmm.
To combat. And man, the next day the soldiers were up and ready to go back and keep going. They didn't go into a depressed state or anything. They were ready to keep up the fight.
Well, that kind of makes me think about my son. So my son deployed to Iraq, and he was infantry too. And his method of communicating me was IMing, which is my least favorite because I don't like to have things pop up in the middle of my, but you know, so I was glad that he was popping up in the middle of whatever I was doing on the computer. Is that how you communicated with your family? Were you married at that time?
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, I was married the entire time I was in the military. Mm-hmm. You know, technology changes. Mm-hmm. And Desert Storm, back in 89, it was mainly one scratchy phone call every few months. And so it's pretty much just letters. Mm-hmm. It was the only way we communicated.
Right.
And as technology got better, you know, 2008, my last assignment, you know, I actually had a hotspot. And we had MWR tents and buildings set up so the soldiers could go online and make phone calls or check the internet.
So, you know, whenever anything bad happened with my son's unit, his unit shut down all communication. So all of a sudden you wouldn't hear anything from your loved ones, you know, so you wouldn't hear from him for a while. And I always knew something had happened, right? It's like, oh my God, something's happened. We can't hear anything. Did your unit have a similar policy towards the end? About like shutting down the internet, or you know, telling everybody nobody can talk until families are notified, or and what do you think about this instant communication? Is that harder on a family or less hard?
It's the same thing. It's very significant when we lose a soldier, and as soon as that happens, we put a guard at the MWR tent so nobody can use the internet or make any phone calls. We understood that folks did have hotspots or maybe had other access to communications, and so we just, you know, there was an order that went out that nobody was to call home until we were told the family had been notified. You know, I lost 21 soldiers in Afghanistan, so it happened quite often.
Right. So how did your family handle your deployment, your deployments?
You know, it's tough on them. It's you know, people call kids army brats. They have a hard life. You know, there's times I'd be gone, you know, for almost a whole year. You know, you have the whole school year you've missed, or birthdays or anniversaries or concerts or recitals. You know, you miss all that stuff, and it's not just the combat deployments. I mean, we probably spent 3 to 4 months a year deployed for training, and we're not at home. And so it was tough on them, you know. I have a lot of, you know, my wife did a great job keeping the kids in the right direction and taking care of them to make sure they had a, you know, a nice home to be in. And it was hard, but we survived.
Yeah, I know that now it seems easier for, well, it's not easier. It's different for this newer generation than when my husband and I were in. There's a more support systems, and there is this, instant communication. You can use the internet or, you know, FaceTime or something. But it's tough. These kids have, you know, they've spent most of their childhood knowing their mom or dad could go to combat. You know, we've been at war for, it seems like, forever. So, hats off to you, your wife, and your kids for, you know, serving alongside.
I appreciate that. It is interesting to see soldiers now that got out of the Army and entered the Army after I got out of the Army. So it's been a long process. We've been in combat forever.
Yeah. So speaking of combat, your last combat tour was in 2008. How long did you stay in the military after that?
So we returned. I returned from Afghanistan in July of 2009. Mm-hmm. My unit was moving to Fort Knox, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. I did not go with them because I was I had been selected for the Sergeant's Major Academy at Fort Bliss, Texas. But man, my brain was just not into it. I was done after all of our losses in Afghanistan, right. And so I retired in March 1st of 2011.
Couple of questions on this. So getting out, the transition. So, when you got out, what did you do? Did you get plugged in with the VA or get a job? And also, what was the transition like from soldier to civilian? Because, you know, you'd put 22 years of your life as thinking like a soldier, being a soldier, and now you're a veteran. And how was that mindset?
I actually got, you know, I guess you could call it lucky in a sense. I interviewed and hired on as a junior ROTC instructor at Albuquerque High School.
Mm-hmm.
And so that transition was easier because of the fact I was still wearing a uniform. I was still teaching Army leadership.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't go cold turkey to where I just went straight into a civilian job. I was a civilian. I was a retiree, but I was certified by the Army. And, again, still teaching the Army. As far as the VA, you know, I did all my appointments and all my evaluations before I left the military. And so the VA was an easy transition. As soon as I returned home, I went there and, you know, and got signed in. And, you know, it's been a good journey with them so far.
Well, that's good to hear. I think the transition to the VA depends on the unit you are in. I've heard some stories of soldiers getting out that had no guidance on how to get plugged into the VA. So I think it's a luck in some ways. But it is good to hear that the VA has been helpful and good for you. So you were teaching at Albuquerque High School, you're plugged into the VA, you're getting your medical and you're having a soft transition. What else did you have going on in that time? Is that when you got involved with Team Rubicon, or was this before Team Rubicon?
It was so that's where my hard transition happened. After about 2.5 years of teaching, my PTSD rating went up.
Mm-hmm.
The Army Cadet Command, who certifies me to be an instructor, without warning and without talking to my chain of command here at Albuquerque, they decertified me as an instructor, which means I lost my job as a teacher at Albuquerque High School.
Yeah.
That was hard. That was pretty tough on me. You know, the VA took that letter and turned around and put me on they basically retired me out as far as my disability. It was tough. You know, that was probably one of the harder times of my life where I had to figure out my next move.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really a lot of traveling, spending time with family, trying to get over the fact that I had been cut at the knees, if you will.
Right.
So that's kind of when I, after 4 years of, almost 4 years of wandering around, that's when I finally saw a commercial for Team Rubicon, and that began my journey with those folks.
So, getting right back to the hard part, so your family, of course, was kind of watching this whole implosion of you, too, and that must have been very frightening, first of all, to lose a job, and then probably, you know, all the self-doubt and everything that happened. So, were they supportive of you? Did they get support from anybody out there? Does the VA give family support to people? What was going on with that? Was there any help?
You know, that was so this happened in 2013. Mm-hmm. I only had one son who was 17 at the time, mm-hmm. Still in the home.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the kids had already moved on to do their, you know, start living their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't, you know, other than my, well, I do have a grandson, he's 14. So it affected them because they knew it affected me.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like when I retired, I gave my kids, my son who was still at home, I gave him half of my GI Bill to use for college. And so after he finished high school, he was able to go to college for a while. But yeah, that was definitely that was a tough time for a couple of years there.
Yeah. So tell me about Team Rubicon. You saw an ad for Team Rubicon, where, on the TV? And then what is Team Rubicon? And what kind of things do you do? And just give us the history and stuff.
Team Rubicon, it was Haiti 2010. A former Marine named Jake Wood took a team and traveled on their own to Port-au-Prince and then drove across the border into Haiti to assist with the earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
when they got done doing that, they decided this is what they wanted to do, and so they created Team Rubicon. So it's a veteran-based, volunteers active in disasters organization.
Mm-hmm.
We deploy all across the country to national disasters, as well as we have medical teams that deploy across the world to provide medical support.
Mm-hmm.
It's been really nice. It's been great for me because, you know, I have a tough time with civilians.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We don't speak the same language. Mm-hmm. My interests are not their interests. My stories, they look at me like, what? So it makes it tough to have that transition into civilian life.
Mm-hmm.
Being a Team Rubicon, I'm around veterans again.
Mm-hmm.
Veterans, first responders, and as they call it, kick-ass civilians.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like-minded individuals. You know, we all have a mission to go out and continue to serve versus, mm-hmm. you know, if it's out delivering meals or cutting trees off of houses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I've deployed to operations in Panama City for Hurricane Michael.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the Bahamas for Hurricane Dorian. I've been across the country for floodings, and I was in Texas a few months ago for a tornado that hit. So it's very refreshing, and again, it's something I enjoy because, again, I get to be around a lot of like-minded individuals mm-hmm. who have a goal to continue to serve.
So I understand you deploy to these things. So you guys do everything from helping people rebuild houses to hooking up water supply. What are some specific jobs?
Well, we do have a rebuild in Houston where they've rebuilt over 100 homes since
mm-hmm.
Hurricane Harvey.
Mm-hmm.
On regular deployments, usually we're the guys that will show up right after the storm is over. And again, we'll go out and clear roads. We have heavy equipment. We have our chainsaws.
Mm-hmm.
We have teams that go out and muck out houses,
mm-hmm.
Repaired roofs. Just do whatever we can to try and get the families back into their homes. We don't do any construction while we're out on those type of deployments. It's mm-hmm. really just to make the area secure for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, accessibility to their homes by cutting trees away from their houses, and getting all the wet furniture and clothing and everything else out of the house so it can begin to dry and they can begin to rebuild their lives.
So do you work closely or have the blessing with, like, the local first responders and the FEMA people and things like that? Do you integrate into the team, or is this mostly you guys are doing your own thing and independently?
No, we are independently. Mm-hmm. We have to be invited by the county
mm-hmm.
or the state. When we show up, we work independently again. It's kind of emotional sometimes. I mean, you see some of these families that are hopeless.
Yeah.
You know, we hang out. We deploy to low-income areas.
Mm-hmm.
Folks who have homeowners insurance,
mm-hmm.
got it. Those guys got their stuff taken care of. We go to the neighborhoods where we know they don't have homeowners insurance, where they are just, again, they're hopeless. They have no idea what they're going to do. They still have a hole in their roof, and it's still been raining. And
right.
They can't get out of the driveway, can't get a car out of the driveway because there's a big old tree sitting across the driveway. You know, so that's where it's really, it can get pretty emotional. Just hugs and smiles is how we are paid. Again, we're all volunteers.
Mm.
That hug and that smile is just, that's what makes it all worth it.
So does your wife volunteer as well with you? Would you guys go together?
So she, after about 3 or 4 times of my deploying, she decided, hey, I want to do that too. So she signed up for Team Rubicon. She went to the Bahamas as well, but we don't usually deploy together.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually easier for us to deploy separate, so you don't have that, you know. Feel like we're constantly checking on each other to make sure we're doing okay. We know we're doing okay, so it's easier for us to deploy separately. Plus, we do have our grandson with
mm-hmm.
us, so
mm-hmm.
we have to kind of share that time.
Well, and you have animals too. I heard your ducks a little bit ago.
Yeah, the goats and chicks. got chickens, ducks, dogs, and cats.
Yeah, somebody's got to be home to make sure they are fed.
I have another question about Team Roombacon. So it sounds like there's a lot of physical stuff, but if somebody wants to get, so somebody can volunteer who wants to do physical things, but is there, are there jobs for people who are not physically capable of building, tearing, ripping up things? I mean, is there stuff for like paperwork people to do, or, you know, teachers, or, Is there that kind of work, or is it all physical for Team Roombacon?
No, we have plenty of teams that stay on the fort operating base. They help keep the base running. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they do a lot of the paperwork or a lot of the logistics, mm-hmm. Preparing mm-hmm. meals or keeping the plate cleaned up. Mm-hmm. We also have crisis cleanup where people, if they can't deploy, they can still be at home, and they're plugged into a program called a crisis cleanup. So as these folks need help and they call the 1-800 number to Team Roombacon, mm-hmm. these folks do the work, do a lead or a work order from home, and then they upload that to the computer system, which goes out to us, and then we contact those families wherever we're deployed at. And we have veterans out there with service dogs, mm-hmm. You know, and they get assigned and they kind of do things that they're able to do. And no, we welcome everybody. Everybody's welcome to be with us.
Okay, it's like a dispatch, like they're the dispatchers or the triage people.
Yeah, they really are, because they can, it's really important. That's a really important job, because the more detail, more information they get from that homeowner, the better we are prepared when we arrive to those homes. You know, maybe they needed extra tarps for a roof, and we weren't normally carrying as many tarps in our vehicles. Uh-huh. So with Team Roombacon, you know, they feed you, fly you, house you. Everything's 100% free. Mm-hmm. They reimburse you for any type of expenses as far as eating as you're traveling, mm-hmm. or baggage fees or any of that stuff. And so it's completely, we take care of our gray shirts.
So I'm assuming that Team Roombacon is a nonprofit that depends on donations and grants and things like that. So if one of our listeners wants to, is it a nonprofit?
Yes, ma'am, it is.
Okay. So if one of our listener wants to get involved, either by volunteering or donating money or, you know, corporate sponsorship, what is the website for Team Roombacon?
It is teamroombaconusa.org.
Okay.
So just log in on the website. It'll have a link there to sign up to be a volunteer. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's also links there for people who would like to donate money to Team Roombacon. And that's how we get out and help people. Mm-hmm. It's all donations. It's, you know, we have a lot of corporate donations, but majority of our donations come from the private donors, mm-hmm. Who maybe can't get out there, don't have the time to get out there and help their fellow Americans, but they can. You know, kick in $5-$10 a month or whatever it is one time. It's just whatever folks can do to help get us out there to help our fellow Americans.
Well, we're gearing up for hurricane season right now. They've said it's going to be a fairly busy hurricane season. And now we're in this pandemic, and I know you guys are kind of bunkered down and doing, you know, local things like food banks and, you know, delivering meals. Are you prepared to go out in a pandemic to a hurricane, and how are you preparing for that?
So they will, Team Roombacon will push out to a 450-mile radius of the disaster area, and try and activate as many of those gray shirts as possible. And those folks will drive to the event, and they're reimbursed for the fuel. And if you have specialties, maybe it's chainsaw instructors or heavy equipment operators, mm-hmm. Then case by case, they will authorize flights and get those folks out to that area. But it is tough because, you know, with COVID, we still have to do all the checks and balances to make sure we're staying safe and keeping our distances while still providing the services to those folks in need.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it sounds like a great organization and a great mission, and it sounds like something that many of our listeners would be interested in. So I would like to just ask you a question. and this is just out of the blue, what advice do you give to other service members who are just getting out now or just got out recently who haven't gone and gotten plugged into the VA or don't know what to do with themselves, you know, with the transition being a little tough, you know? What advice do you give to these people that are just now going through what you went through several years ago?
Veterans, a lot of veterans are angry. They've had their issues in the military versus mm-hmm. it's traumatic or just, you know, my biggest advice for the veterans is, man, be patient. Be patient. Show up to your appointments. You know, I get veterans who will talk bad about the VA when asking questions. And a lot of times I come to find out they actually were a no-show for an appointment, and when they went to reschedule it, now it's 6 months. Mm-hmm. And now they're angry because they have to wait 6 months to see a doctor. Mm-hmm. You know, be patient. Get your appointments. Go to the main VA hospital. They have all of the offices there to get you signed up. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, it's, you're receiving care that you have earned as a veteran. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But they're not just going to pass it out. You got to do your time. You got to go and make your appointments. You got to sit in the lobbies, and you got to do that. The steps, because if you don't, you know, a lot of veterans, I know a lot of veterans who hardly ever go to the VA because mm-hmm. all they do is complain about it, and yeah, I got it. You know, there's a lot of, the VA has its issues, they're still trying to get stuff figured out as well. It's mm-hmm. a big flux of veterans mm-hmm. trying to get service, but mm-hmm. man, you've got to be patient.
Mm-hmm. And what inspirational words can you come up with for kids that are just now graduating high school into this pandemic and into an economy that's bad? And, you know, do you have any thoughts on how you would, well, how would you encourage your own he's older than 17 now, but I mean, how would you encourage your own kids when they get up and they see we're in a pandemic and there's, you know, people yelling at each other and there's protests and the economy's bad? What kind of advice?
Trust the way you were raised. I mean, people care about you. You know, go out into the world. Continue to, you know, find your adventures. You just got to be safer now. You know, you've got to do what's required of you. What the government says, you know, that you need to do to stay safe. And just, you know, don't hole up in your house and think that, you know, there's nothing out there that you can go do. There's plenty of stuff you can do. You can do it safely. Mm-hmm. You can still go out and you know, do your college online until they allow you guys back into the universities. But, you know, I feel bad for a lot of folks who decide to stay home. I mean, I understand that's part of the pandemic, but people have gone into depression modes because they just feel the life that after the world is ending. But you've got to stay positive. Things will get better. We'll get back to normal, normalish. Mm-hmm. Again, just be patient.
Well, I think that's good advice. You know, I give myself some consolation that we've had other pandemics and, you know, the most recent, well, there have been little pandemics of certain flus and certain diseases out there that have happened and we've adjusted and life has gone on. It's just that right now we're sitting in the middle of one or maybe not even the middle yet. And so we can't see the end. But, you know, life went on after, you know, the flu of 1918, 1919. Life is going on after, you know, AIDS crisis. You know, life goes on after Ebola. So as a community, we can pull through and pull through on our resources and our friendships. So I think that was timely advice. So we're going to have to wrap it up. But do you have anything you would like to talk about in general for the next couple of minutes about Team Rubicon, about yourself, about school, kids, service, anything?
You know, I would say if you're a veteran, if you're a first responder, if you're somebody that's out there who has that desire to continue to serve, mm-hmm. even if you can't leave the city or leave the state, come join me. You know, come out there and help me. We're always trying to find new gray shirts because, you know, there's always somebody in need. That's what keeps me going back because there's somebody else I can help. There's somebody else out there who can't help themselves. Mm-hmm. And if I have the ability to do it, then I've got to do it. It's just, it's built in, you know, I'm built to serve. And So come out and join us. As far as contacting me, I mean, it's, you know, if you look up Team Rubicon, you know, they also have a Facebook, New Mexico Team Rubicon Facebook page, and mm-hmm. so you can contact us through there as well. That's pretty much it.
Okay, well, I will add the links to the Team Rubicon website to the bottom of the podcast site, and then people can go there as well. Well, I think this has been interesting and inspiring. You know, it's like you served and you're continuing to serve. It's in your DNA.
It is.
Yeah.
I have my Team Rubicon stuff on now, and I'm not even deployed anywhere. It's a constant reminder to, it's coming.
Mm.
Hurricane season was started on 1 June, goes all the way through November.
Yeah.
So we'll be out there sooner or later.
Yeah, and forest fires, and thinking about Arizona already, you know, there's a lot of natural disasters coming. Well, good. So I need to wrap it up now, and so I wanted to tell our listeners that our podcasts are I'm so excited about Team Rubicon. So our podcasts are supported in part by New Mexico Arts, the New Mexico Humanities Council, Sandia Area Credit Union, as well as organizations such as Military Brats Registry and Military Brats Seal. And I wanted to thank you, Larry, today for joining us and telling us more about, you know, volunteer opportunities that I had never heard of Team Rubicon. So I wanted to say it's been a pleasure speaking with you and learning something new.
I appreciate you taking time to talk to me today. I hope you have a really great day.
Well, thank you, and you too.